back to the AstroCast. I'm your host, Rue. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024, and the full moon is officially upon us. You know, it could be a cool thing if you're into lunar photography. Not so much for me. I haven't quite gotten into mono astrophotography yet. Friend of mine, Ryder, actually was giving him a hard time a couple days ago because he was posting about the beautiful weather conditions that he was recently experiencing down in his gorgeous Bortal 1 skies down in Nil, Australia. And he had commented that since the skies were nice and clear, even though it was a full moon, he didn't really need to worry about that since he is now doing narrow band mono imaging. And I said, out of the way, peasants, I am doing my narrow band mono imaging. So had to give him a little bit of a hard time about that. So shout out to you, Ryder. I hope you're doing well. And I hope the mono imaging is going along great for you. He actually did some awesome shots of the Fighting Dragons Nebula, which is one that I hope to capture in the future. It's very, very low in the northern hemisphere, where I am anyway, which is around, I believe, 38 degrees. But he's got a great view of it in Australia, and he did an excellent job of that, one of his first targets in mono. And it's incredible. So if you want to check out his shot, you can certainly go check that out at Knight Rider Astro. And, you know, there were a couple of things on last week's episode when I was listening to them, it occurred to me that I need to mention to you guys. And I was thinking about it because, you know, we're a good bit into this show now. We've been going for a few months and there's a lot of, pay for play in the industry, maybe not in astronomy so much, but podcasts, YouTube, that sort of thing. And I just wanted to be really clear with you guys on something. If you ever hear me mention a product or a website, it's because I'm interested in it, or I see that, you know, somebody is offering a deal on it and I think you guys might be interested in said deal. If I ever partner with a company in the future and, you know, they're sending me a review unit or they are, you know, sponsoring the show or anything like that, I, of course, will let you know that I am partnering with them. The reason I mention that is because I realize that I have mentioned Agena Astro and High Point Scientific several times during the last few shows. And I know that there are other astronomy vendors out there besides those two. I predominantly do most of my shopping through those two vendors, but there are lots of other great reputable stores out there. And I'm going to do a better job in the future of making sure that you guys know that there are other vendors available as well. So just wanted to be really upfront with that. The other thing, which is not related at all to vendors, was when I was talking about, viewing the Milky Way, from high altitudes. Last week, I had mentioned seeing zodiacal light from a very dark sky location, but I didn't actually explain what zodiacal light is. And I pride myself on always trying to teach at least one or two things during the show for people who may not know what these things are that I'm talking about. So I wanted to mention zodiacal light is a phenomenon that occurs generally at very dark sky locations. And basically, this is light that appears from the ecliptic. And if you're in the northern hemisphere, you're generally going to see it in the spring or in the fall on the western horizon just before sunrise. So it's going to be, you know, before astronomical sunrise, I should say. So just before light starts coming up over the horizon, you can actually start to see some light emanating from the ecliptic. And the ecliptic, for those who do not know, is the path that the sun and the planets appears to take in our night sky as and our daytime sky, for that matter, as the sun and the planets travel along the sky's path. The ecliptic is what we call that. So this is actually interplanetary dust that is within our solar system and is extremely faint light that most people will never see. You have to be in an incredibly dark area to see it. And honestly, from the place that I'm going to be at my dark sky location, even though it's technically a Bortal 1, I don't think I'm going to be able to see it because I don't think I'm going to have the altitude to see it. I think there's going to be too much, you know, disturbance and humidity within the air to see it. But if you were in a really dark, you know, Bortal 1 with a high enough altitude, then I think you would have a better chance of seeing it. And I think the best time to see it, they say, is late in the spring. So that is what zodiacal light is. You can feel free to read about it more. I think more people tended to see it, you know, decades ago. I know I've talked to some of the old timers at the observatory and they've told me about seeing zodiacal light, you know, years and years ago before light pollution was nearly as bad as it is these days. And I always love hearing about it. It's something that I really do hope to see one day. I don't know that I'll be able to, but I certainly hope to be able to see it one day, just like I hope to be able to see the Aurora Borealis. So that's our recap on zodiacal light. So in other news for myself, I am beginning to lay the mental framework of building my first pier, which is going to be for my observatory at the house. I believe I've pretty much gotten the okay from the wife to build a very small observatory beside the driveway in the front yard. She doesn't listen to the show, so hopefully she won't murder me. It's not going to be anything huge. I'm just going to build a very small building, nothing with a warm room or anything like that, because it's going to be right beside my garage. I just want something that I can put one pier inside of. I can swap out the telescope. I don't mind doing that. But yeah, I'm starting to think about where I'm going to put my pier. I believe I've got a really great spot for it. It's going to go beside my driveway, but the idea is to have a roll-off roof observatory that I can automate, that I will be able to, you know, gather a lot more data with. I still ultimately want to build an observatory down at the observatory, which is, you know, the Charlotte Astronomers Club. But I think to learn the process of and get ready for that bigger project, this is the perfect way to do that. So that's going to be something that I'm planning on breaking ground on very soon. So all that being said, today, what I would like to talk to you guys about is something that I briefly touched on last week, and it is Pix Insight. So this is something that I have been thinking about talking about on the show for many weeks, and I was kind of struggling with how to tackle this as a topic on the podcast for a couple of reasons, because I'm not foolish enough to think that I could do a audio tutorial for something as visually impactful as Pix Insight. There are plenty of tutorials on YouTube that will walk you through step-by-step workflow for exactly what to do in Pix Insight. So I am going to tell you what I like to do in Pix Insight. What I'm not going to do is literally take you through step-by-step exactly what you need to do to get everything done. I'm going to give you a brief rundown of exactly what I do in Pix Insight. But what I don't want to do is, you know, break it down to the very, very detailed level, because frankly, there's a lot of videos online that you can watch that are going to give you better detailed instruction that have visual aids with them. They're going to be, you know, much better for you to watch, if I'm being frank. And I say that knowing that it could drive a little bit of, you know, listeners away to go watch videos instead. And that's obviously not what I want to do. But I think there is a whole lot of great stuff that we can talk about with that being said, and lots of good stuff that we can cover. So the first thing to talk about is, you know, who is Pix Insight for? So Pix Insight, first of all, is kind of the top of the line astrophotography processing program. So there are several of different applications available that anyone can use, ranging from free to paid to subscription services and kind of everything in between. And I personally have used the vast majority of what is out there. And I ended up on Pix Insight after using a free trial two times. And I'll speak to why I used it two times a little bit later. I think in one of the earlier episodes, I got into the various differences between the different apps. But briefly, Photoshop is something that early before PixInsight got really popular, a lot of people used. I know Trevor from Astro Backyard used to use Photoshop pretty much exclusively for all of his work. And, you know, lots of other famous astrophotographers, well, relatively famous astrophotographers did as well. Cyril is a very, very good program for processing astrophotography images. I am not personally that experienced with Cyril. It is one of the few applications that I have not personally used, so I'm not going to speak on it. I'm not going to say whether I think it's great or whether I think it's bad because I haven't used it. So I'm just going to leave that at that. If you want to read about Cyril and, you know, check it out, I've heard good things about it. I've heard that it can do most of what PixInsight can do. I've also heard that it can be a little bit more tedious in a lot of ways to use. I figure there's a reason that PixInsight is as popular as it is, even though it's a pretty costly application. Then again, most things with astrophotography, they are pretty costly. So I think we all know that when we get into the hobby. Well, maybe we don't know it right when we get into the hobby, but we all figure it out pretty soon after. So AstroPixel Processor, that's another great one. So that's actually what I started with. I believe that is, let me check on the price for that one. So the owner's license is going for £165, or you can rent it for 1 year for £60. So whether you want to rent or own is up to you, but that's how much AstroPixel Processor goes for. I believe when I actually was using it, I rented it. I'm kind of glad that I did rent it, though, because by the time that I was kind of big enough into astrophotography where I decided that I was ready to step into PixInsight, it took me about a year. And by that time, I felt like I had pretty much figured out AstroPixel Processor for the most part, and I was ready to move on to PixInsight. So that's another great one. Obviously, there's lots of other tools that you can use as well. Lightroom comes to mind. You wouldn't use Lightroom to actually process your images. It's more of a final touches sort of thing. I do use Lightroom for final touches on pretty much all of my images. If I want to, you know, tweak the contrast or tweak a color here and there, or move some light around, that sort of thing, Lightroom is great. And then there are lots of side programs, if you will. Deep Sky Stacker is a great one for stacking all of your photos. Now, that being said, if you use PixInsight, you won't need Deep Sky Stacker because it has an excellent built-in application called Weighted Batch Pre-Processing. And that basically does what Deep Sky Stacker does, but in my opinion, does a much better job. And it can actually do some pretty fancy tricks that I don't think Deep Sky Stacker can do, though I haven't used Deep Sky Stacker in quite some time, so it may have had some updates since I last used it. Now, as for the cost for PixInsight, it is currently going for 300 euros or $329. Now, that is a permanent license. I will say that rumor has it when they move to the 2.0 version, there may be an upgrade fee associated because they're looking at it as a whole new piece of software. From what I've heard, they're not going to be selling it as like a brand new standalone piece of software. So there should be a steep discount for people who already own the current version, which is, I believe, 1.8 point something or other. So, you know, I take that for what you will. Obviously, companies can do whatever they want when they're selling their software. They can say one thing and do another. But my best understanding is that when they inevitably move to 2.0, you should be getting a steep discount, and 1.8 should still be available should you choose, you know, not to upgrade to that 2.0 version. You'll still own the permanent license for the other version, which is a really great version, which pretty much has, you know, everything that you need built into it. Now, everything that you need built into it is kind of debatable. And the reason that I say that is anybody who owns PixInsight is pretty quickly going to discover that there are some plugins that are pretty much must-haves. I think it really just kind of depends on your definition of must-have. I slowly added these on as I felt that they were necessary. I am a firm believer of only purchasing more gear and software as your skill demands it. So instead of going out, you know, and buying top of the line telescopes or, you know, top of the line, whatever, why not buy something, you know, not cheap, but perhaps slightly less expensive, and then maximizing it, getting the absolute most that you can out of it first. And then once you've completely mastered that, then upgrade to something more expensive. And don't hear me wrong. I'm not saying go out and buy cheap gear. That is not what I'm saying at all. But I'm just saying that you need to, you know, get your money's worth out of all of your gear that you buy. We see this so often in this hobby where first timers go out and they buy way too much scope for a first time buyer. It happens all the time. They go out and they buy the, you know, Celestron bundle that's an AVX with a 9.25 inch Edge HD, and they have no idea what to do with it, and it's way too much telescope for them to handle. They get frustrated. It ends up sitting in their closet, and they end up selling it after a month or two because they just can't figure it out. So that's what I mean. PixInsight is no different. It can be a very, very complicated tool. So you need to kind of slowly learn as you go. Luckily for us, there are a lot of great resources for learning as you go. So you don't need to go out and immediately buy all of these plugins to get the most out of PixInsight. For example, there is a great plugin called Star Exterminator. And we use this to first remove stars from our picture. So then we can adjust the nebulosity of our nebula to get it exactly, you know, how we want it and really make it pop and, you know, bring the colors out, et cetera, and then put the stars back in and even reduce the stars if we want to make them smaller and make them more pinpoint, et cetera. And it's a great plugin. It works really well. But there is also a plugin called StarNet 2 that does almost, some people would argue, just as good of a job as Star Exterminator. So, you know, do you need to buy Star Exterminator right off the bat? I wouldn't say so. You could say the exact same thing for a Gradient Exterminator. I have not purchased Gradient Exterminator, and I'll tell you why, because there is a free tool called Graxpert that is a plugin for PixInsight that is excellent at removing gradients. I mean, it is top notch. They came out with an AI plugin. I don't know if you'd say AI plugin, but they basically have an AI version of Graxpert now. I guess it's been nearly a year now since the AI version came out. But ever since then, Graxpert has been, you know, hitting way above the punchline, if you will, for what it costs. Punchline, that doesn't make any sense. It's what's the word I'm looking for? It's punching way over its class. There you go. So you really don't need to spend all of your money on these right up front. So make the most out of what you have, because you, like I say, you're paying $329 up front for this software. Now, if you've got the money to go out and, you know, spend $600 up front to buy every plugin plus PixInsight, you know, by all means, go for it if that's what you want to do. But if you're like me and you don't have a ton of disposable income, then, you know, get PixInsight first. Start with a free trial even. Get your toes wet, see if it's for you, and then you can kind of slowly add these things on as they're needed. And I think that's the best way to go about doing it. So we'll get more into the plugins in a little bit here. I want to start with kind of what my process is when I'm working in PixInsight, how I learned what that process is, and just, you know, how I go through my workflow and what might help you a little bit with yours if you're getting started. So for me, when I first started with PixInsight, I believe they give you a three-month, it's either a one-month or a three-month free trial. It's a pretty generous free trial, and I unfortunately kind of let it slip through my fingers. I logged into it one time, and I was just overwhelmed looking at it, and I was like, man, I can't even figure out anything about this. And I'll tell you this right up front, if you try to just log into it without any video tutorial or any kind of help whatsoever, you will be overwhelmed too. You're going to be confused. You're going to be like, where is anything? There's a bunch of crazy names in here. I don't recognize any of this stuff. And you're basically just going to get confused and close the app, unless you're some kind of savant. You probably won't be able to figure out too much. So initially, that's what happened. I just wasn't in the right mindset when I picked it up the first time. So I ended up closing out of it. I probably went back to AstroPixel processor. And, you know, I used what I knew was working and just kept it moving. But a few months later, I was curious about PixInsight again. I believe I had seen a processing video online on YouTube. And I was like, man, I really, really need to give that app another try. So I opened it back up and saw that my demo had expired. And I really didn't want to drop the $300 yet because I wasn't sure if it was right for me. And so I emailed the guys over at PixInsight and said, hey, I explained the situation, and they actually gave me another demo license, which I thought was really cool. So they gave me another demo license. So I loaded that up and I went searching for a good tutorial, and I looked through quite a few. So I'm using, as many of you know, if you're regular listeners of the show, a one-shot color camera. It's the ASI 294 MC Pro. And I found Luco Matico's tutorial. It's called PixInsight Beginner's Tutorial Part 1, One-Shot Color M45, Free Data Provided. And this is a great beginner's tutorial. And when I say great, I mean great, because he not only takes you step by step through every single thing that you need to go from, I know absolutely nothing about PixInsight, to this is a finished image that looks pretty good. But he also includes things like icons, which is something that we'll get into here in a little bit, that you can drop onto your desktop of PixInsight that speeds things up greatly for you. I still use those icons as a baseline for all of my PixInsight processing. And I will provide a link to this and them in the show notes so you can too. And, you know, if you don't have data, he actually provides data that you can use. I actually used my own data because I had data that I had, you know, recently acquired when I wanted to first start learning PixInsight. So I wanted to use that instead of the M45 data that he was using. And you can do the exact same thing. So I used my data and followed along with him. And the beauty is, you know, you can pause it, rewind it, stop, replay stuff, and just go at your own speed. And he takes you through step by step everything that you need to know to get through and come out with an awesome photo. So the first thing that you really need to do whenever you're getting into PixInsight, in my opinion, is to do what's called blinking your photos. So whenever you get all of your images back after a night out, the first thing you want to do is check and make sure that your data is good. And what I mean is just do a preview of all of your images and just check to make sure that they don't look terrible. So, you know, it occurs to me that before we even get into that, we should probably talk about installing PixInsight. So why don't I pause for just a moment and we can talk about that. All right, so this is actually a little simpler than I thought. Basically, you just need to go to the picksandsight.com website. After you purchase your license, they will actually send you an email with your activation code. You are going to download the appropriate installer, whether you're on Mac OS, Linux, or Windows. You run the installer. After the installation, you will get a pop-up asking for your license code, and in one of the emails that you received will be that license code, and you just simply copy and paste your license activation into that box, and then you're good to go. And if you ever, you know, need to reinstall it, you can go on their website and sign into your account with your email address, and they will actually resend you another license as well. I've actually had to do that a couple of times after having to reinstall Windows on my computer, and they're pretty quick to get you a new copy of your license. So back to blinking your data. So you get all of your files back at the end of the night. Let's say that you went out to a dark field and you were using an ASI Air and you took all of your photos on a thumb drive that was plugged into it. So you get back home, you plug your thumb drive into your computer, and let's say that you've got dark frames, flat frames, and light frames. And we'll just say that you don't have bias frames for this argument. I actually don't use bias frames. I do have to use dark flat frames, but we won't get into that specifically today. I think I am going to do an entire episode about calibration frames in the near future, because I think that should probably be said at some point, but that's not for today's episode. So the first thing that I like to do is I like to put it on my scratch drive, which is a separate fast drive that I have on my computer. So I actually have two M.2 drives on my main computer. One of them is the one that runs Windows, and the other one is what I call my scratch drive. So that's what I do all my photography work on, as well as my astrophotography work. It's important that you have a very fast drive for your photography work, because we're working with very large files and we have to copy and paste these files back and forth. We have to open and close them quickly. And just generally speaking, anytime you're working with very large files, you want to have them on the fastest drive possible. So what I like to do is copy them off of that thumb drive and then copy them onto my M.2 drive into a new folder. And I'll generally name it after the target that I was shooting that night. So let's just say Elephant Trunk Nebula. I'll open that folder and then I will say lights, darks, flats. So I'll have three separate folders in there, one for lights, one for darks, one for flats. Now I will copy and paste all of the lights into the lights folder, all the flats into the flats folder, and all the darks into the darks folder, correct? Okay. So then you're going to go into PixInsight. So this is our first time actually going in here and looking in something. And at the top, you'll notice a lot of different options. You got file, edit, view, image, preview, mask, process, script, workspace, window, resources. I know it can be overwhelming, but the vast majority of the stuff that you're going to do is going to be either in process or in script. You will also use masks sometimes, and then you can use view and image sometimes, but most of the stuff gets done in process and script. So for this case, what we're going to do is go to process, and then we're simply going to go to all processes, which is something that I like to do because all processes is easy, because you don't have to go through all the sub menus that you see down below, because it puts all those sub menus into one big folder so you can look through everything. And you want to locate the one that says blink. Okay. So open up the one that says blink and you should see a big window. It'll have a, a square in the upper left hand corner with a orange kind of 3D look. I don't know what you call that, a wave symbol perhaps, and then bubbles above it. But anyway, near the bottom of that window, you'll see a folder symbol, and that is where you can load up various files. And this is where we want to open our lights. And this might not seem like a big deal, but when I was early into astrophotography, I can't tell you how many times I went searching for an app that would let me preview FITS files and couldn't find one because I wanted to be able to do exactly this. I just wanted to be able to sort through my data quickly and find any subs that just looked bad, you know, streaky stars, you know, near the meridian, that sort of thing that just needed to be quickly eliminated. If I could tell that it looked terrible quickly, I wanted to just be able to quickly remove them from the stack and move on. And that's what Blink allows you to do. And it's a great little feature. And I actually didn't find out about it until I had been using PixInsight for quite a while. So maybe one of you out there who is using PixInsight or is new to it doesn't know about Blink and you just found out about it through me. If you did, congratulations. So go ahead and use that folder button to load up all of your lights. And it should be fairly self-explanatory through here. It'll load them all up in a list and they'll all be checked off. And you can just use the arrow button on your keyboard to flip through. They're going to be in mono here, mono color, that is black and white. And you can kind of just look carefully at the stars and see if you notice anything out of the ordinary, if they're streaky, you know, or anything along those lines. And then if you do see that any of them don't look good, you can then remove them from your folder at this point and say, I am not going to use these. One neat little trick that you can do here, if you want, just uncheck the files that you don't want to use when you're doing this. And then when you're done unchecking them all, you can press the little scissors button at the bottom, and that will allow you to move all of the checked files to a new folder. So if you don't want to have to go back and literally delete each of those files in the, you know, Explorer window, if you're using Windows, you can just, you know, uncheck them all here and then move them to a new folder. And that can speed up your process a little bit. Sure, you'll have to go back and delete those other files later on. But right now, if you just want to stay to being in PixInsight and speed up your process a little bit, that's one good way that you can do it. Also, while you're looking at the actual picture of the stars, use your mouse wheel to scroll up and down to zoom in and out on said stars. And this is how you can get a closer look if you want to do a little bit of pixel peeping, particularly if you're using a really wide field view. Like if I'm using my 135 rig, it's going to be zoomed way out on the stars and it's going to be hard for me to tell if anything's streaking just at a glance. So I need to be able to zoom in, you know, pretty far to be able to tell if anything's out of the ordinary. So use that mouse wheel to scroll up and down and make sure that all your stars look good. So for me, after I've blinked the images, the next logical step is to get into the weighted batch pre-processing step of PixInsight. And this is where we actually combine all of our calibration frames with our light frames to get one cohesive image that is stacked together that we can finally process into the final image. Now, this can be really complex or really simple, and it kind of really depends on your setup. I'm not going to get too deep here because it very, 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 very much depends on your specific setup. If you have a one-shot color camera like I do, generally speaking, and I'm going to say very generally speaking, you should be good if you are using lights, darks, flats, and either bias or dark flat or flat dark frames. Although you may not need flat darks or dark flat frames, and you may not need bias frames. For the first year that I did astrophotography, I got away with just light frames and dark frames. I started adding flats at a later date, and it very much improved my pictures. And then I realized at a much later date that I needed to be using dark flats to calibrate my dark frames to my flats, which is a entirely different conversation. And that's really because of the specific camera that I use, which is the ASI 294 MC Pro. And for this particular conversation, I would recommend that you look into your specific camera's needs. I will say, generally speaking, though, I would highly recommend that you do use calibration frames. They're going to improve your image. Dark frames are very simple. What you need to do basically is just, as the name implies, it is a dark frame. So for me, what that means is making sure that I put my 294 camera in as dark of an area as possible, and then I cool it to the same temperature that, you know, I was shooting the target that I was shooting at, negative 10 or negative 20, depending on, you know, what I was shooting at. Usually I do negative 10 and I'm happy with that. And then I take exposures for the same length of time that I was exposing. And I usually use 3 minute subs with my 294. As they seem to be, you know, the best fit for me. So if you take 3 minute exposures with your lights, then you want to do 3 minute dark exposures too. And this goes for if you're using a DSLR camera, a cooled camera, no matter what kind of camera you are, you want to match the exposure time of your darks to the same as your lights. Now, what does vary is when you need to do the dark frames. So if you're using a DSLR camera, you need to do them when you're in the field, because the temperature at which the camera is operating does matter. Because if you try to take those darks the next day when you're at home, the temperature is going to be completely different and the sensor is in a different environment and your darks are not going to calibrate properly. So it's one of the big advantages of having a cooled astronomy camera is that you can build what's called a dark library. And I can, you know, set my camera to, you know, automatically take 60 second, 120 second and 180 second exposures through the ASI Air app all day long if I want. And then I can do that every 3 to 6 months as needed. And that's my dark library. Whereas back in the day when I only had a DSLR camera, I was forced to take dark frames at the end of each session. Which, as you know, if it's a late night and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you're exhausted and you're ready to go home, the last thing that you want to do is sit around for 33 minute exposures, because that is exhausting. So it's just one of the big, you know, things about having a cooled astronomy camera. It's just a huge advantage. So flat frames, on the other hand, they help us calibrate out little defects and impurities in our images. So if you have like dust on your lens or on your sensor, a flat frame is going to help you calibrate that out. There are a lot of different ways to take flat frames. I personally, I use like the t-shirt method, as a lot of people call it. So I will put a white t-shirt over my telescope. Sometimes I will double the layer up. And then I will use a diffuse white light. I actually have what's pretty much a flat panel light. It's actually a tracing light that I got on Amazon for $20, but it works well for what it is. And it plugs up USB to my battery, thing that I take with me on all my trips, and it does the job. You have to adjust the time on these to get it to where your ADU, which is the exposure on your histogram, is around 30,000 is generally where you want to be with flats. And this is going to vary a little bit depending on your camera. Again, with the 294, you want to have 2 second flats or more. And most cameras are not like that. Most of them you can get away with significantly shorter flats, but flats are important. So make sure that you look up and see, you know, what kind of flats your camera needs, because that's going to take away anything like, you know, dust that you have or dead pixels. Those, well, maybe not dead pixels. That would be the darks. But if you get dust or anything on your sensor, your flat can take care of that. And flats are something that you do want to do at the end or beginning of every session, because you're, you know, if you pick up your telescope and move it, then the dust that is on the lens or the sensor can move. If you rotate your camera, then that moves. And if anything moves in your imaging train, or if any of that dust moves, then your flat needs to be taken again because the old one isn't going to work. So keep that in mind. Fresh flats always need to be taken. Darks are the most time consuming by far, because again, they need to match the amount of time that you're taking to your light exposures. But flats are pretty quick. Once you get, you know, relatively good at taking them, it'll only take you 2 or 3 minutes to do at the end of the night. I've gotten, you know, very used to taking them, and I can knock them out real quick at the end of the night, even when I'm extremely tired. So make sure you take your flats at a, you know, bare minimum. Take your darks and take your flats, and I promise you, your images will thank you. All right, so we've talked about our calibration frames, and now we want to load them up in weighted batch pre-processing. So how are we going to get there? In PixInsight, what you want to do, again, at the top of the screen, you're going to go to Script, and then you're going to select Batch Processing, and then Weighted Batch Pre-Processing. Go ahead and click on that, and it can take a minute to load up Weighted Batch Pre-Processing. It's a pretty heavy script as far as scripts go in PixInsight. One thing that you'll notice is this script tends to remember what you did last time in it. So as you use PixInsight and start using it over and over again, you will notice that your darks, flats, and lights from last time are in there. It's easy to reset it if you need to. At the bottom, there is a reset button. You can always click on that, and it's going to give you a few different options. You can always hit clear all file lists, and then it'll just reset everything for you. And then, of course, you can select the individual, you know, lights, flats, or darks, and then reset them individually that way as well. So if you put all of your files into the folder structure that we talked about earlier, or if you're using something like an ASI Air and it's naming all of your files appropriately, such as, you know, light and then flat and then dark in front of the file name. Technically speaking, in weighted batch pre-processing, you can just press the plus directory button at the bottom, or add files button at the bottom rather. And you can just select all of your files at one time. And generally, it does a pretty good job of putting them in the right order. So putting all your lights in the lights area, flats in the flats area, and darks in the darks area, etc. I, however, I'm just kind of used to doing them individually. I'll do my lights first, and then my darks, and then my flats, and then my bias if I need to do them. You can do this either way. If your files are named appropriately, by all means, load them all up together at the same time. Just using the plus files button if you like. This is really just up to you, however you want to do it. So go ahead and click on those and load up your individual files when you're ready. And when you're done, you should be at a screen that says calibration up top. You'll see several different tabs, and the calibration one will give you a pretty good idea of what's going to be happening. So you'll see status, and if you get a good green check mark, that means that you should be pretty much ready to go. There's a lot of different indicators that you can get here, and obviously a lot of different settings to play with. I'm not going to get into all of the different settings. We're just going for a basic stack here. So once you've got your lights, darks, and flats loaded up, let's go ahead and do that, and then click on the post calibration setting. And from here, we can change a few different settings. The one that I want to talk to you guys about is drizzling. So drizzling is a really cool feature that PixInsight has. And it's an awesome feature for me in particular, because I have the Rokinon 135 and I'm currently using it with the 294 MC Pro. And with most astronomy cameras, you're going to end up with an undersampled image, unfortunately, which means if you are a pixel peeper and zoom way in on the stars, you're going to notice they look a little bit blocky. And that's just unfortunately because it's such a wide field of view. You can't get enough resolution within that field of view with such a small sensor for it to get really fine, you know, round stars. And drizzling helps to alleviate a little bit of that squareness. So if you're using a super wide field setup, or you know that you have an undersampled setup, Drizzling can help you alleviate some of that. Now, the cost of that is that it's going to make your file size much larger because it is effectively increasing the resolution depending on how much you scale the image up. So for my example, since I'm using my 135 rig, I am going to go ahead and enable drizzling, and I'm going to go ahead and do a scale of 2. So it's not going to make it super huge, but it is going to make my processing time a little bit longer than it would have otherwise been. But I'm okay with that because I would like my stars to be a little bit prettier than I'm seeing them in the blink feature right now. And that will do it for me. So play around with drizzle, try it disabled, and try it enabled with your setup. That's the best way to kind of get a feel for what it does. And, you know, try it with different scales, try it with higher scales, lower scales, et cetera. And you'll get a quick idea for exactly what it does, particularly if you know you're undersampled. Like I say, astronomy.tools is an excellent website to help you calculate whether you are over or undersampled with your gear. I didn't realize until, you know, nearly a year after purchasing my particular gear that I was undersampled on my main rig, not the 135, but my 80 millimeter refractor. And drizzling helps me overcome that. It's not terribly undersampled, just slightly undersampled. But if I do a drizzle factor of 2, you'd never know the difference. It looks beautiful whenever you do a drizzle of 2. So that's a really cool feature that PixInsight gives you that I don't think you can get from any other apps. I could be wrong about that. Serial might offer drizzling. Like I say, I haven't used Serial, so I can't really speak on that. So after you've got that done, there are some other options here. You can select the maximum speed or quality on the right for presets. I always go for quality. I am not in a hurry. I've got a pretty beast computer. I guess it's starting to get a little bit older. It's a Ryzen 7 5800X with a pretty new graphics card. It's got a 4070 Ti in it. So a really good graphics card, and I've got 32 gigabytes of RAM. So it does a really good job processing. No trouble there whatsoever, but I have heard of people saying it takes a very long time for them to process their images. That's all going to vary depending on your hardware. You know, if you're using a small or, you know, older computer or older laptop, it could take quite a while for this process to do its thing. That just depends on your gear, to be honest with you. So my MacBook does a pretty good job with PixInsight. I've actually used it before. It's an M1 MacBook, I think a 2022 or 2021 model. And I was kind of shocked by how well it actually does. So anyway, after you are done selecting drizzle, if you would like to do that, and selecting your quality, you can go ahead and go over to pipeline, and it's going to show you the estimated disk space that you're looking at. You can also select the output directory in the bottom right-hand corner. If you want to change the directory, by default, it's going to be in the, I think, the PixInsight output directory. I just have my own setup on my Scratch directory. And then you can go ahead and click run in the bottom right-hand corner, and it'll give you an estimate of how much working space it needs. It can take up a lot of working space depending on how big your files are. If you're using something like an APS-C or full frame camera that has very large file sizes, then you can expect PixInsight to need a lot of space to do its thing. So just be aware of that. You know, I have a 2 terabyte M.2 drive for my Scratch drive, and I try to always leave, you know, 500 gigabytes minimum free on it that I can use to work with. It's kind of the whole point of having a Scratch drive, so you can scratch it up. You know what I mean? And just be aware of that. You're going to need some space if you're going to be using PixInsight. It's got heavy lifting to do. So go ahead when you're ready, hit run on that, and then continue. So after PI finishes processing and stacking your image, you'll be returned back to the pre-processing script screen. And from here, you just want to press the exit button, and it'll take you back out into the main PixInsight screen. Now you want to go ahead and hit File, Open, and then you want to locate that output directory that you selected earlier. And from here, you want to go ahead and find your image. Now, by default, it's going to give you a few different options that you can pick from. There's generally going to be a cropped version and a non-cropped version. In this case, since I drizzled twice, there's going to be a drizzled version and then a non-drizzled version. I like to go for the largest possible file. That way I can be sure I'm not getting the cropped one. And I believe sometimes you can also get a rejection image as well if you're getting rejects. But in any case, go ahead and open up the largest file possible in this case, just so we can make sure that we're getting the right one. And give it just a moment, and it's going to load up that image for you. And you'll likely get a, like I say, a weighted image or a rejection image as well. You won't really need to worry about that at the moment. Just pull that out of the way, and you'll likely get a unstretched image. So it'll be mostly black with some white dots on it. And that's just going to be your raw unstretched image in its linear state. It's funny because when we started this episode, I told you guys that I wasn't going to take you through my exact process of how I do PixInsight. And here we are like 45 minutes later, and I'm taking you through my exact process of how I do PixInsight, which is quite hilarious. And we're coming up to the hour. So I think what we're going to do most likely is make this a two-parter, where this is going to be week one, which is basically just talking about PixInsight, the install process, and getting to a stacked image in its unstretched state. I'm actually going to show you how to go ahead and stretch that image. It's very simple, so you can at least get to where you can see what the stretched image looks like. It's very simple. If you look in the upper right-hand corner while you have that black and white simple image selected, you'll see in the upper right-hand corner a button that kind of looks like a nuclear symbol. It's black and yellow on top of a monitor, and it'll say STF auto stretch if you hover your mouse over it. It's the one, there's a lot of buttons on the top toolbar, and it's the one all the way to the right. And if you click auto stretch, it should, as the name implies, automatically stretch your image for you. And then you should be able to see some nebulosity. Now you might see, depending on what your bear pattern is on your camera, you might see a lot of green in your image. This is normal. This is perfectly normal. And there is a process that we need to apply to the image that is called the SPCC process that we will be doing next to remove that green. And in fact, let's go ahead and do that. So what we're going to do at this point is we are going to go to process at the top of the screen. And then we're going to go back to all processes. And we're going to scroll down to spectrophotometric color calibration. And that's SPCC for short, but spectrophotometric color calibration. And when we open up that tool, you're going to see a whole lot of options. We don't really need to worry about these options right now. What we want to do in the bottom left-hand corner, you're going to see a triangle and a square. So the triangle, if you drag and drop that onto the image, that gives you what's called the new instance. So it will apply the change to a, as the name implies, new instance of the image. So it should essentially bring up a new copy of the image. Whereas if you press the square, it will apply the tool to the open image that you already have in front of you. So in this case, let's just go ahead and hit apply. You can press F5 on your keyboard if you prefer. I'm just going to go ahead and click on the square since I have it right in front of me. And if you give PI just a moment, it should pretty quickly remove that green color for you. This is a super cool tool, and it is something that you can do very early on that's going to give you very accurate colors. It'll also kind of show you how your image is weighted out in terms of colors, because right after you run it, it'll actually bring up a white balance screen that'll show you how your colors are split on a dot diagram, which you can see that'll pop up, red and greens, blues and greens, etc. It's a really neat tool, and I use it, like I say, every single time that I make an image, and I think most people do as well. There was an older tool that was just PCC, but I don't think anybody uses that anymore. SPCC is the new way that everyone goes, and it's a great tool. So SPCC, it's a good one. So that's going to do it for the tutorial process for this week. So we've got PixInsight installed. We have gone through weighted batch pre-processing. We've stacked an image together, and we've done an auto stretch on it, and then we have done a color calibration on it. So we've gotten our image to a good baseline. We can see a pretty picture here, but we still have a long ways to go before it is to its final product. We also have a lot of other stuff to talk about as far as the plugins are concerned. We didn't even get into Blur Exterminator, which is a huge one that we need to talk about. Honestly, it's my favorite plugin, and I think most astrophotographers would tell you it is their favorite plugin amongst all of the RC Astro plugins. Noise Exterminator is a big one because it does an excellent job at removing noise. And we will get into all of these next week as well. We didn't really have a need yet for all of the icons that we use on a daily basis when in PixInsight. However, that being said, I am going to link to Luca Matico's video. I want to once again send a big thank you to him. He is the inspiration for this week's episode, because without his video, I wouldn't be sitting here telling you all of this information that I am today. So big shout out to him. I do not know the guy, but I do like his work. So thank you to him and his YouTube channel. I'm going to link to his video, and I will also link to the icon set that he provides within that video. So that's going to do it for the PixInsight part of the show. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I know we haven't done a real deep dive into astrophotography tools lately, and I wanted to make sure we got back to that sooner rather than later. We talk about a lot of different stuff on the show, but astrophotography is always at the heart of this podcast. So I wanted to make sure that we got back into it this week, because I kind of felt like we were straying a little bit from the heart of what we like to do here at the AstroCast, and that's talk about astrophotography. So next week, we are going to continue this episode for part two, which is when we're going to talk about, continuing the processing of this image that we are working on. And, I think I'm going to put together a little data set for you guys that we can kind of process together, because I was thinking about it. I don't want to nothing against Luca Matico at all. But I don't want to offer his data up to other people without his permission. I don't mind linking to his YouTube video, because I'm sure he wouldn't mind getting more views on it. But I think I will put together a little data set. So if any of you don't have your own data and you'd like to follow along with me, you can do that. So I'll make sure that I upload that onto Google Drive. So if any of you guys want to download it, you're certainly welcome to do that. It's not going to be anything huge. I'll probably put like 10 lights, 10 darks, and 10 flats together in a file folder, so you can follow along with me as we put the files together. So for recommendations this week, I've got a pretty cool one, and I hope that you guys will be interested in this. So I don't know how many sci-fi fans we have that listen to the show, but a few years ago, I finally got around to reading Dune, which is obviously kind of the mother of all sci-fi novels. It inspired pretty much any sci-fi book that you have read or any sci-fi movie that you have seen. It has taken from Dune. So if you've never read the book and you do enjoy things like Star Wars and Star Trek, et cetera, highly recommend that you give Dune a read. But Dune 2, I was able to go check that out in theaters with a friend last week. And man, it was good. It was so freaking good. I was kind of blown away by how good it was, because I'm going to be frank, I wasn't that impressed with the first movie. Don't get me wrong, I liked it. I thought it was good, but I didn't think it was phenomenal or anything. The second one was phenomenal. I mean, like, honestly, I think it might have been the best sci-fi movie I've seen in the last 20 years. It was that good. So if you get a chance to go see it in theaters, they're still showing it at a lot of the places around Charlotte. I know that it's streaming right now and you can go online and rent it for $25. I would highly encourage you to go see it in theaters, though, just because it is a very theatrical movie. The way the music is with the loud synths and the way that the music hits and the huge sweeping visuals that they have in the movie, it's very much a movie that is made for the big screen. If you can't go to the movies, obviously, highly recommend you check it out from home if that's your only option. But if you have the ability to go check that one out in theaters, please do, because it's really, really good. So other than that, I know that our buddies Rick and Jeff went to NEEF, and I have not heard the report back from them yet, so I don't know how it went. I know that a lot of cool new products got released or announced at NEEF. I know that ASI released or announced the 2600 Air, which I personally not a big fan of. I mean, I see what they're going for and everything, but I would not want to buy a camera that has an Air built into it just because it's too many points of failure in one device. So like, you know, if my Air fails, I can always swap it out for another Air. If my camera fails, I can swap it out. But now it's like, you know, you're combining all these devices into one thing. And if, you know, any one of them fails, then you're screwed. So I don't know. I mean, it's cool, but it's just, you know, your guide camera, your imaging camera, and your computer all in one device. While it is very, very convenient, if anything breaks out in the field, you know, you're just kind of screwed. So I don't know. I got mixed feelings about that one, but I'm glad that they're releasing new products. You know, I'll say that, I guess. And I also will say, I think, I could be wrong about this, but I think it's the same price. I think they said it was $19.99 or expected to be $19.99. So if it's the same price as what they're going to be charging for the Duo, then that kind of makes it a no-brainer if that's the case. If they were charging a $300 premium, then yeah, forget about it. I'm not going for that. But, you know, if it's the same price as the Duo, then yeah, heck yeah, I'd buy it then. But otherwise, no thanks. So that's kind of where I'm at on those in particular. So anyway, I think that's going to just about wrap it up for this week, guys. So I appreciate you tuning in and listening. If you haven't gotten a chance yet, the Patreon is live. If anyone wants to go over there and check it out, we did add a new tier last week. It's $1 a month if you're interested in supporting the show at the Happy Dude level. Want to give another shout out to our subscriber at the $5 level. And if anyone wants to join, please feel free to do that. I am your host, Rue. Thank you for tuning into the Astrocast. I hope you all have a wonderful week. Try to get out there and do some astronomy. I know that it's a full moon, but hopefully you get some clear skies and get to enjoy it anyway. We'll be back next week with another episode, and hope to see you soon. Clear skies. It's actually a radio show from NPR, and if you don't know it, well, I don't know if we can be friends, but I suppose if you go and listen to it now and correct your error, then we can be friends again. It's called Radiolab. Go check it out. One word, Radiolab. If you haven't listened to it, you have an entire world of amazing episodes to hear. Go check them out. See you next week. Clear skies.